Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, September 23rd, 2010, if you're in North America. It's Friday, September 24th, 2010, if you're in Europe, where I am. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets and Ask Catherine, then a discussion I'm calling live from Switzerland. And I'm going to speak to you about a theme, our theme tonight, which is inspired by the quote from Deuteronomy, I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live. And my theme tonight is choose life. I wrote a blog post that describes some of what I'm going to say called faith and the way forward. It was from a piece that I wrote in 2002 called Solari and the Rise of the Rule of Law, and I want to talk about it because we're coming into a new and more serious phase of the transition that we're in, and the number one tactic that's being used against all of us is really a desire to cause us to give up hope and to stay unfocused on the things that are important to building a wonderful future for ourselves and our children and our grandchildren and the generations to come. And it's important, to see this aspect of the game and to choose life. There's a wonderful section from the prophet in the section on the poem on children, and it talks about life's longing for itself. And it's true, if you understand the law of attraction, life attracts life. And it is very important in your spirit not to let go of life, because it is our love of life and our reaching out for life with both hands that is part of what attracts life inside a world which sometimes now seems more like running through a gauntlet than inside the Disney world that many of us lived in 20 years ago. But first, money and markets, media. The silliness on declaring the recession over by various sources is now reaching new and stupefying levels. We saw one economic group insist that the recession was now over and any new economic problems would relate to, it would be a new recession. This coming into election, of course, protects the Republicans who were concerned that the old recession started in the Bush administration, but now that it's over, all new problems will, of course, not be tied back to the Bush administration. Of course, all this is silliness, because if you look at the problems in the economy, they're very deep and they go back decades, and each administration has been making our situation progressively worse as they centralize more control. The most amazing story in the media is the Italian government seizing $23 million that the Vatican Bank was in the process of wiring to two banks in Frankfurt, one of them including J.P. Morgan Chase, and announcing an investigation into two of the top bankers. Now, what this story is about, I have no idea, and I've spent several days really trying to find out, but this is a very important story. It's a very big story. The Vatican is the single most powerful network and organization in the world. There's both the overt Vatican, the Church, and then there's the covert Vatican, which includes arguably the most powerful financial interests in the world. You're talking about an organization in which 1 billion people pay tithes, or some subsection of 1 billion people. They have diplomatic immunity and globally and a tax exemption. Now, that's a formula for financial success over 2,000 years. And it was funny, I'm on a listserv with a group of financial blogosphere luminaries, and one of them sent out a message saying, well, the Vatican is controlled by the CIA. What do you expect? Something big as a foot. And I wrote back and I said, wait a minute. I've been assured for years that the CIA is controlled by the Vatican. But it's sort of a typical discussion these days as to who really controls who. You've heard me talk about the Midianite thing, and it's a reference to the Gideon army story in the Old Testament about the Midianites capturing Israel and getting thrown out of Israel, essentially because they lose a battle against Gideon's army, because they wake up in the dark, get afraid, and they're so deeply suspicious and distrustful of each other that they attack and kill each other. And I call that the Midianite thing, when the top guys turn on each other. And whatever this story is about, the seizure took place on behalf of the Bank of Italy. So you have the central bank going against the Vatican Bank. And so whatever the story is, the Midianite thing is seriously afoot. The news on the election continues to be very interesting. The confidence in the administration continues to fall. There was a new poll from Rasmussen, and I never cease to be amazed at Rasmussen's ability to ask the right questions. It shows very low rating for the economic advisors. 26% of those polled had a favorable opinion of Geithner. 32% had a favorable opinion of Bernanke. So the central bank is way ahead of the Treasury here. There was no calculation for opinions of Larry Summers because, of course, he announced earlier this week he was going to resign. Now, Summers, in many respects, was a lead architect of the strong dollar policy, the suppression and manipulation of the gold price, and the bubbling of the housing market, and has a habit of putting his foot in his mouth, and also made good and glorious amounts of money consulting with hedge funds after he left serving as president of Harvard. So it was to be expected that the Republicans were probably going to have some fun with him during the election, and I suspect that it was the administration that strongly encouraged Summers to head for the door and head back to Harvard. There was no poll of Volcker, who's really not perceived to be close into the president despite various insistences by the president. Volcker was quoted this week as saying, we are in a, quote, big depression, quote, globally, and asking the question as to what we're going to do if there is permanent massive unemployment globally. Now, these are all questions, good questions to ask, but I have to admit that when I hear someone like Volcker talking about this, it's one of those moments that tests the power of my ability to stay in a state of amusement no matter how absurd things get. Dick Ravitch, who's the current lieutenant governor of the state of New York, worked for me and my company in 1997 as a consultant. And it was Dick Ravitch who, over dinner at the Jockey Club, said to me the quote, which is at the top of my article, The Myth of the Rule of Law, quote, so long as I can get government subsidies, he had developed several housing projects with HUD money, so long as I can get government subsidies, what do I care if people have education or jobs? Well, I went to see Dick several years later, I think it was about 99 or 2000, and he at that point had moved into, he had become a roommate with Paul Volcker in a suite of offices that were quite lush at Rockefeller Center, and they were busy making tons of money. Now, if you go back and look at Sir James Goldsmith's warning in 1994, that if we continued to behave this way, that massive unemployment was afoot, Volcker clearly couldn't care less then when it was when there was still time to turn the aircraft carrier. So the fact that he's wandering around and bemoaning what we all knew, not only, in the late 90s, but in the early 90s, is the absurd or frustrating. So anyway. But the time has really come where we need economic advisors who can feel what it's like to participate in all roles within an economy. Because if you economics is really a human art. If you can't understand the economy from the point of view of the different roles in it, then you can't understand the economy. And we really have, we really can't afford any more economic advisors who are members of the protected class. Food and health, I continue to post an awful lot of information about the food bill on the blog. I know that Harry Reid said it won't pass, but it is so horrible, it is so bad, that in the spirit of turning the aircraft carrier before, while there's still time, it's very important before the election that everyone be in a position to make it very clear to their representatives that this thing needs to be torn up and shredded. If you're skeptical about my claims that there's a conspiracy afoot to control the food supply or put small farmers out of business or use processed food to poison the population, I really encourage you to read the blog post in the bill because it's absolutely terrible. Dealing with debt and deficits, you're beginning to see a new acronym. QE2 does not stand for the Queen Elizabeth sailing ship. QE2 stands for Quantitative Easing Round 2 and is referring to sort of coming into this period of the Fed pumping and printing extraordinary amounts of money. There was one interview quoted where a former Goldman Sachs hedge fund manager predicted that it would take $30 trillion of debasement to sort of work through the federal deficit and the sort of contingent liabilities that have been made. We talked about last week with respect to the U.S. debt clock. We have pressure from the Secretary of the Treasury encouraging the Chinese to revalue their currency up. The Chinese now coming back and saying they can't possibly do it. A 20% revaluation would lead to massive unemployment in China and chaos. We're really tied at the hip because if you see how things have been working, the Chinese have kept employment high by making goods for Wall Street, which are bought by people with government subsidies, which is financed by the Chinese buying treasury. So around and around we go. And both countries are trying to manage through debasement of the dollar and many fiat currencies while they keep the employment chain going. Now, part of the challenge that hasn't come out yet, you see sneaky little headlines, is a lot of this debasement is going to significantly debase pension funds because so much of the paper and the dollar paper has been sold into pension funds, not just in the United States but around the world. And, of course, we talked last week about the confiscation threats in terms of what the policy proposals are on the IRA and 401k. That's something we're working to write more about. Again, I don't think anything's going to happen before the election. But because of the Bush tax cuts probably going away at the end of this year, looking at what to do about IRAs and 401ks is something that many people are going to have to start seriously looking at this year. We had a very chilling announcement from the UK. The equivalent of their Internal Revenue Service is proposing to run private payrolls through the taxing authority. What that means is literally a company turns over its entire payroll to the equivalent of the IRS, who then takes the appropriate taxes, appropriate according to them, and then turns the check over to the employee, presumably by electronic transfer. Among other things, the importance of the float involved is extraordinary. When I was on Wall Street from 1978 to 1989, during those 11 years, the single largest source of revenues to Wall Street was float. You would hear stories back in those times of someone selling stock in a Merrill Lynch account and being in New York with their Merrill Lynch office in New York, but getting a check on a bank in Hawaii that would take, enormous amount of time to clear. That's float. So the float would be very, very significant. Currently, the UK does not have withholding, and so if you look at their situation, I can see why there's more pressure to come up with this kind of plan than there might be here. But it's a very chilling fact that they've made this proposal, and it doesn't bode well because when something starts in the UK, it has a habit of ending up here. If you look at the bond market, I continue to have debates back and forth with a variety of people of why you shouldn't buy bonds of any kind. You should buy gold. And it's an interesting dialogue. I need to think of a way to present this all on the Solari report. The reality is if all sovereign bonds of all nations in the world are worthless, then we're going to have a situation where you're going to have a very difficult time protecting your gold. At that point, it's going to be a lot more important to own plenty of whiskey, vodka, guns, and bullets. Because if all the sovereign governments and all the militaries are or in default and collapse, it's going to be very hard to protect your gold. So I think that comes more from a mentality of the likelihood of collapse. And again, I continue to be in a camp of slow burn. What I said all year long is for 2010, I think 70% chance of slow burn, 15% chance of another 2008, and 15% chance if the Midianite thing happens that that first 15% really spirals out of control. But that's a long way from where we are to a situation where no bonds have any value. The greatest danger here is not governments. The greatest danger is what Richard Dolan and I talked about, using his term, the breakaway civilization, and sort of finding ways we can get to align governments with us instead of aligning with the breakaway civilization is really what we need to be doing. And by that, I don't mean being, you know, tolerating things like the food safety bill, but doing everything we can to get government working for us. And that's why I continue to say it is very important who we vote for, and it is very important how we communicate during the elections, because it's a chance to talk to our representatives, and there's still a lot of good representatives in there, and we need to send them back in. A new Congress and some changes in the Senate could make it much harder to do some of the laws that are being proposed, whether it's food safety or shutting down the Internet or all sorts of cuckoo and crazy stuff. In the precious metals markets, not surprisingly, we're seeing new nominal highs. Gold ended today at $12.93, silver at $21.13, gold-silver ratio down a tad, 61.233. My high for the year continues to remain at $13.50, but I just, even though we're at a nominal high, we're not close to an inflation-adjusted high. And this bull market has much further in price to run and a much longer time to go because, as I said earlier, we're just entering a very serious part of this transition. And we have a long way to go. Now, there are many others in the market who are much more bullish this year than I am in terms of price, and I would just caution you to be careful because I think many of those folks continue to underestimate the power of the system to subsidize financial assets, whether it's the stock or bond market, by extracting real value from real people in the real economy. And that's why I'm much more concerned about the real risks to real people in the economy and the dangers of things like confiscation. In the housing market, steady reports of misery in the housing market expect this to continue. My hero this week, speaking of good governments, is the entire Mexican government, who's moving forward with plans, this is up on the blog, to ban all junk foods from public school by the start of the coming year. Now, if you look at how much money school officials can get from selling junk foods and having vending machines, I mean, Mexico is a country that is significantly more challenged economically than we are, but if they value their children more than that money, good for them. Now, I would like to point out, believe it or not, that what this means is in 40 or 50 years, if they do this and we don't, the Mexican people really will take over America because their people will be able to function and think, and ours will not. So it's something to think about, and it's certainly, I tip my hat to good government at the Mexican government. Ask Catherine. We have lots of wonderful feedback on last week's interview with Robert Lustig, Dr. Lustig, who's a neuroendocrinologist. I hope if you haven't listened, I really recommend it. It's quite extraordinary interview, quite an extraordinary doctor. One of the questions I got as a result is specifically, what is it that I did that made such a difference for me? And here's exactly what I did, and this came from a wonderful subscriber whose doctor is in cahoots with Dr. Lustig. First of all, I stopped eating any sugar or anything with sugar in it. Yet one of the mistakes I'd made was I was using agave nectar instead of honey, and apparently that turns into fructose and is not a solution. So, and I hadn't been eating much sugar, but I would get intense sugar cravings in the afternoon, and I was still drinking organic Blue Sky Cola, which I love, but that had to go. So no sugar or anything with sugar of any kind. part of the magic for me was I could have a pot of coffee in the a.m. So a great pot of organic coffee in the morning. I could have as much whole fruit as I wanted. Whenever I wanted something sweet, I could have plenty of whole fruit. No restrictions there. And if I really had a sweet tooth, I could have organic honey. Just don't overdo it. Now, Lustig said in his interview that it takes 3 weeks to break the sugar addiction. Now, what I found, and I'm somebody who, ever since the litigation ended in 2006, I've been on a significant detox and supplementation program as well as an exercise program that has really brought me a long way, but I couldn't beat the sugar addiction, and it was really frustrating because I just couldn't, you know, no amount of discipline could beat it. It was really a problem, and yet when I started on this formula, literally within a week, I had no craving for sugar whatsoever. Lustig said 3 weeks, but for me it was much faster. So everybody's different. Again, I, between the detox and all the supplements I take and exercise, that may have made it easier for me. I can't say everybody's different, but if you struggle with sugar addiction, I really recommend his work. It's very sobering, and one of the advantages of listening to his presentation, Sugar, the Bitter Truth, which is posted on the blog post, or listening to the interview, is it's very inspiring because you realize, wait a minute, this stuff is really dangerous. I've got to do something. Another question for Ask Catherine, GATA versus the Fed, any progress on GATA's suit against the Federal Reserve? The Fed provided us with an additional round of documents in trying to comply with the FOIA request. Our review of those documents indicates that they have little relevance, and certainly we don't believe complete our request for FOIA information about their transactions in the gold market. They have filed a motion to dismiss our lawsuit, and we are still awaiting a hearing to be scheduled. There's been no hearing. It's sitting there, and of course, one of the things that happens with suits like this is it can go for years just, you know, sitting in the docket waiting for a hearing. Another question, Cliff High said Americans in a decade to become would be known as people of wisdom. Is that due to understanding the error of our ways, or is it because of our technology or something else? I don't know. I know Cliff has a new report out, and I haven't had a chance to read it. This is Cliff High of Half Past Human, who's been on the Solari Report now twice. And I know I've been asked, because several people are concerned that it says something dramatic is going to happen in November. Indeed, you know, when we come into these kinds of transitions and there's real stress in the financial markets, gold is running up, what of course happens? We have events like 9/11, which give a lot more power to the people managing the economy to, you know, sort of assert their will and extract subsidies from the real economy to kind of keep the financial assets subsidized. And so I think there's real pressure to hold the markets up and keep things going through the election, but there's no doubt about it that the risk of, you know, this kind of event risk after the election is significant, you know, and frankly may be, from their point of view, necessary to keep the slow burn going. So I think November, December could be a very sensitive time, but I will read Cliff's report and comment on it if I think it's useful. Okay, well, that's it for Ask Catherine. I am in a grand hotel looking over the Luzerne Lake, and it's absolutely beautiful, but there's no Wi-Fi in the room. It's just down in the lobby, and they've closed down because it's after 3 a.m. in Switzerland. So if you post your questions, we'll pick them up from the software, and I will endeavor to answer them in the future or by email. So forgive me, I will not be able to pick up on them as we go, or I will not be able to pick up on them live tonight, but we will catch them and endeavor to get them answered. So live from Switzerland, I wanted to just, as I move through the day and the weeks and the months, I have all these thoughts that I want to share with you, and sometimes I'm reticent because they're too philosophic. But the number of these sort of philosophic thoughts has been growing. And so I thought I would take the time while I was in Switzerland to simply communicate them to you, because I always have a lot more of them when I'm in Switzerland. I used to have somebody work for me when I was at HUD who used to say, I need to go get my perspective. And whenever I'm in Switzerland, I find it much easier to get my perspective. And it's a place I feel very much at home in. And it's a place that, as the great quote from Gertrude Stein that I put on the update, inspires confidence in people. Gertrude Stein said, in a war, everybody always knows all about Switzerland. In peace times, it's just Switzerland. But in wartime, it's the only country that everybody has confidence in, everybody. And there's no doubt about it. The Swiss have lived through lots of good and bad times, and there's no population on Earth that does as much to prepare against disaster and war as the Swiss. I'll bet you it's probably even better armed and trained in weaponry than Hardeman County, Tennessee, where I now hail from. The Swiss are remarkable people, and they're much more prepared than we are. If you look at their laws, they have worked very hard both with their culture and how they manage their money to be in a position financially and culturally to support their laws. I think one of the real clues to me that we were in real trouble is when the Swiss were literally forced off a partial gold standard in the 1990s, and that's when I realized the power of what I call the breakaway civilization to literally force even the Swiss to their will. I think one of the reasons the Swiss culture is so responsible and so reliable in many respects is because they have had very sound money. Many of us don't appreciate the very intimate connection between culture and currency. When you have a sound currency, you have a communication device that allows literally billions of people to communicate the value of their time without taking up each other's time. So I can look at a pair and know that it's X dollars, and it's either worth it to me to buy it or not at that price. And embedded in that price are literally millions and millions of decisions and preferences by millions of people as to how much it costs to grow and transport and present a pair in a grocery store versus how much time it takes for different millions of people to earn enough money to buy that pair. And so currency communicates optimization and allocation of our time in a very collaborative way. And when a currency tricks and lies, in part because it sends us a wrong message, so cheap dollars say, oh, you can afford this pair or this house, when in fact you can't, or it says, you have plenty of money for your retirement, when in fact, when the currency is debasing, you wake up, and that was a lie, you really don't. And so a sound currency can communicate effectively between millions of people and through time, or an unsound currency can cause enormous miscommunication both between millions of people and through time and space. So I think the Swiss experience can teach us a little bit or show us a little bit of an example about the kind of culture that results from sound currency, because I think that's part of what you're seeing here. Now, my goal with the Solari report at the deepest level is really to see you succeed. We are in a transition, and I want you to stay alive. I want you to thrive despite the change. We got a wonderful question from a wonderful subscriber, and I just want to read it to you because it's one I've thought about a lot. It says, global depopulation, all signs point to official depopulation. How do I live in this kind of world? GMO, Frankenfish salmon, chemtrails, Monsanto vaccines, TARP bailouts, Kennedy King, Kennedy assassinations, CFR, Bilderbergers, trilaterals, et cetera, et cetera. The main thing that I cannot seem to reconcile and resolve is the concept of global depopulation. How can I live with optimism for the future? How can I raise my 5 beautiful children with this actually happening? How can I not be in flight or fight survival mode when the powers that be want me dead? I love my life, and I love my family, and I love my planet. That's a great question, and it's exactly the question that I grappled with in 1998 when I decided to really start Solari and do what I'm doing now, which was, can I be happy in the midst of what looks to be like a global depopulation? Can I be happy when we have a pro-centralization team which is centralizing economic power, and if this goes the way it's looking to go, literally intends to reduce my family and the people I love to a form of high-tech slavery or a high-tech feudalism? Can I live in that, and can I succeed in that, and can I be happy in that? And finally, my answer was yes, and a lot because I see the opportunity. If we're going to change the central banking warfare model is failing, and so we have to replace it. Now, the pro-centralization team have their vision. It's not a vision that I think will succeed, and it's not one I share. So the question is, okay, well, they have a vision. We need a vision on the pro-decentralization team, and that's what we're struggling to emerge. Because we're all on the pro-decentralization team because we don't like centralization, which means we tend not to organize together. So part of sort of emerging a new vision is, how can we do that when we're so many people in so many places? By what process can we emerge it? Interestingly enough, I'm going to spend my weekend on the top of a mountain in Switzerland with a group of people from all around the world who came here to talk about how we emerge a new vision of a new model. And it's going to be very interesting, and I'm very much looking forward to it. So I have 10 sort of points I want to cover in no particular order, but they very much have to do with what I've learned about staying alive in this kind of environment, and I'm hoping that they will help you. Number one, we need to revisit our strengths. We, and when I say we, I know that the people on this phone call or listening to this audio file are people from every different culture and walk of life, many different cultures, many different nationalities, many different spiritual practices. But the one thing we have in common, if you look at the history of your family, wherever they came from and whatever your background, what you will discover is that what they have overcome to arrive at this point and to produce you at this point are absolutely amazing. I'll never forget when I first moved to Hardeman County, Tennessee, my cousin and I went and found the original log cabin of our original ancestor who came over from North Carolina in a wagon train to try and get away from the Civil War. Apparently they didn't go far west enough, but it was a one-room log cabin. A family of 10-plus people lived in it. It had had a dirt floor, no windows, and obviously no running water. And if you look at what they managed to accomplish coming out of that log cabin, and I assure you it gets below freezing in Tennessee during the winters, but it was a reminder to me of what was astonishing. And if you look at what only 4 or 5 generations have managed to accomplish in our family and in the entire society, it's quite amazing when you think of how far we've come in just 100 to 150 years. One of my favorite quotes that you'll see up on the Solari Advisor website is from Winston Churchill. He says, "We have not journeyed across the centuries, across the oceans, across the mountains, across the prairies, because we are made of sugar candy." Now, we live, if you live in the first world, there's a very good chance you live in a culture and a society that has become very babyfied. I realized in horror at the end of the 90s, I was talking to a dear friend, somebody I love, and they were completely focused on their consumer power and all of their delightful consumer options and had no realization. They didn't even fathom that their political powers were slowly being eroded and drawn away and were being replaced with all these consumer choices that would delight them. And it made them feel powerful even though their power was being eroded. And it was a process that I sometimes refer to as babyfication, where they were being delighted and catered to as consumers in a way that made them babyfied. And part of that was literally withdrawing from them any information about the real world, including information about the real world, which is unpleasant and unsettling, but is part of what people need if they're going to live a mature and responsible life, let alone exercise their responsibilities as a citizen under the U.S. Constitution. So part of revisiting our great strengths is not only understanding who we are and where we came from, but reassuming our political power. There is no doubt that we under the Constitution, we have enormous powers, and the Constitution is very clear. Those powers come to us by divine right. We create government to serve us. Government does not grant those powers to us. They come by divine right. Now, this is why I harp so much on turning off our TVs, because, and as much corporate media as you can, I appreciate some of us need to read some corporate media to stay abreast of certain things, but now is a very serious time, and we cannot afford disinformation. I am constantly amazed at how much time all of us lose to disinformation. It's a very expensive, both in terms of time, but in terms of sort of energy and emotional energy. Now, it's hard because we live in a period of uncertainty, and we don't necessarily have great access to information, and I hope the Solari report can help to change that. But we cannot afford disinformation, so if a source is not trustworthy and corporate news is not trustworthy, please be very careful of your time and your energy. Okay, number two, I'm not one of those people with a lot of magnets up on my refrigerator, but I saw one at Whole Foods, I don't know, about a couple months ago, and I couldn't resist, and I bought it. It's a quote from John Cage, and it says, "Begin anywhere." When you're in a period that is this difficult and this volatile, the time to change is now. Most of the people on this call belong to cultures or to nations which are not as prepared as the Swiss. But the Swiss have endured many wars and many experiences. Many of us come from nations which are younger or cultures which are younger. The time to begin our preparation is now. Don't worry that we haven't done it before. Just start. Power comes from taking responsibility for a problem. And so if we say, you know something, I'm part of a group of people who hasn't prepared, and that's my problem, and I'm going to take responsibility for that problem, and that's how I get my power. I get power for it from literally assuming it, if you will. I once had a friend who became a Buddhist, and she looked very fretful, and I said to her, what in the world is the matter? And she said, well, I've learned that I'm responsible for world peace, and what that means to me is, you know, everything that's going on now, it's become all my fault. And I said, no. It means, you know, don't think of it that way. You need to think, I'm responsible for world peace. Wow, I have the power to create world peace. So part of it is really gathering and coming to your power. Number three, prepare for spiritual battle. I talked in my blog post about the relationship between money and law and culture, and of course that goes to spirit. I'll never forget when I was at FHA, I quickly learned that the White House and the Secretary couldn't care less what was going on in terms of a lot of the day-to-day and very important work of managing 500 what's now $500 billion plus of mortgage insurance. And what I discovered was what I've discovered many times dealing with money, that ultimately when you look at the pricing of financial assets and liabilities, at the heart of the pricing is an estimation, whether it comes through the markets or it comes through the decision of the leader at the time, as to what has value. And what has value ultimately is a cultural and then a spiritual question. And it's interesting because truly great money people really understand what is real and what has value. And part of making the change that we're going through is coming out of this silly bubble made possible with cheap money and getting back to saying, okay, well, what is real and what has value? And ultimately, that's a spiritual question. And it's one that each of us has to ask and answer inside of our own heart and mind and spirit. Now, it's important to understand that we're dealing with forces that are invisible, not just value questions, but literally forces that are invisible. And I mean that in three respects. First of all, it's not my nature to try and persuade people as to a particular spiritual practice, including my own. But one of my favorite quotes from Ephesians in the Bible is, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." Literally, if you talk to Franklin and me, we believe in angels and demons. If you talk to some of the people Richard Dolan is writing about, they call it interdimensional intelligence. But we are dealing somehow with interdimensional intelligence, and it's important to understand that it's real and it has influence. Another way possibly to say this is what you may often see articles that I post from Paul Levy, who's a Buddhist who I love, writes a lot about what I sometimes refer to as the field, and how many things in the field are non-local. I was taught in spiritual warfare that evil is a spirit. It's literally, think of it as a virus that passes around people. It's a wonderful movie called Crash that explores how evil and anger can literally transmit through people like a virus, like a disease. And in spiritual warfare, you're taught that the goal is when a person comes to harm you in whatever way, whether it's financially, legally or other, the goal of evil is to get the humans fighting, so to get you to attack back, whereas spiritual warfare is about helping that person become separated from the evil that's moving through them and help win them back to the light. So we're experiencing a lot of things moving through the field in non-local ways like a virus. And it's one of the reasons many people need to find forgiveness, to come clean, to not practice anger, all of these things. If you haven't seen the movie Crash, it's a good way to explore it. I'll be talking next year about one of my favorite books for spiritual warfare, which is C.S. Lewis's book about the instructions from the devil. It's quite extraordinary. Then the third thing I wanted to mention on invisibility, if you will, is I'm just going to tell you a story. When I was in San Francisco in 1999, it was at one of the most intense periods during the litigation, and I was followed by someone who was clearly following me, and they followed me for the day before and then that morning when I went to an office building in San Francisco. And as I left the office building, I went up to get some coffee for the group of us, and the person proceeded to follow me up, and then when I turned and came back with the coffee, they walked ahead of me and went around a corner, and I came around the corner literally 5 seconds later, and they were completely gone. And there was absolutely no place for them to go. There was no door. There was no car. There was nothing. And I called up a friend of mine who works in one of the intelligence agencies, and I said, do you guys have the ability to, you know, to go invisible? And they said, yes. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. All I can tell you is that story. It's the only way I can explain what happened to that fellow. But I have become convinced just from my experiences with the physical harassment that, in fact, we are dealing with invisible forces, and they may even be material. So during the process, I'll never forget, I was at church one day, and my pastor said to me, he was preaching, and it was like he was speaking just to me, but he was speaking to the whole congregation. He said, you're worried about what other people think about you. He says, you've got a bigger problem. You and God see everything you do, and you need to worry about that. And what I learned was, in fact, if I just worried about that and stopped worrying about, you know, sort of the bad guys, that, in fact, I didn't have too much to worry about. So it's a higher standard. Anyway, so we are struggling with forces that for many of us, one way or another, are invisible, and we need to respect that. Expect miracles. The law of attraction, I know many of you have probably heard or seen the movie The Secret, which describes the law of attraction, but the law of attraction really works. We really can attract to us what we are and try and be, and that is why it is so important to stay in a higher mind. It is so important to choose life and attract life. And there's no doubt we're in a situation where things can go wrong. For all my experience and knowledge, I chose to invest tremendous amounts of time and money in building up a home base in Hickory Valley. And it turned out, you know, that's not going to work for a variety of reasons. But it's the nature of the process, and we need to just keep moving towards that which works and that which, and away from that which doesn't. The Course in Miracles, which I've never fully digested, begins with a wonderful phrase that I have used many, many times. Nothing real can be lost. Nothing unreal is real. And if we just keep moving towards that which works and moves away from things that don't work, it's amazing what can happen that's positive over time. Number five, be practical. We need to think, many of us have been exceptionally spoiled by the bubble. We need to get back to basics, food, clothing, shelter, and organization with others who can help us with food, clothing, shelter, energy. You know, this is an elemental time, and what we're going to see this year and continue is the pricing, the inelastic demand of food, clothing, shelter, and other elemental things are going to increase and become much more important parts of the economy. Number six, turtle. Turtle is my expression for how I deal with really difficult days. One of the things I've spent a lot of time in my life in and out of the covert side or dealing with different kinds of violence. And the important thing is to never let your mind snap or your emotions get drained. And a lot of that comes down to just turtling forward no matter what is going on. It's a little bit like keeping your, like on those game shows when the gorilla is making noise and trying to distract you, and you've got to keep your focus and not turn around and look at the gorilla. I used to always keep a list of things. I'm a list maker, so I would keep a list of all the things I needed to get done. And on the worst days, I would, you know, literally the only thing I could get done was possibly clean my closet. But I learned the importance of, no matter what was going on, of moving forward on doing what would build my future. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got was, in fact, from someone who'd been very senior in covert operations for the CIA. He was the guy who tracked down and did the electronic tracking on the assassination of Pablo Escobar. And he said, you know, you have to learn in the puzzle palace when things get really bad to just lay down and let it roll over and don't think about it. And that's part of turtling, and it's very important. Number seven, this is a long-distance run. We're not in a recession. We're not in a depression. We're in a deep structural change. It's a deep change because the central banking warfare model is 500 years old, and whatever's going on with the UFO phenomena and the breakaway, with the breakaway civilization, these are very serious, very fundamental changes. So, you know, when I use the word financial coup d'etat, I don't use it lightly. And we're in a very fundamental change. I suspect, I've said many times, the planet's being harvested of a huge amount of money. And, of course, one of the questions is, now that $4 trillion has been taken from the U.S. government and $12 trillion has been taken in the bailouts, how are they going to get their next round of money? But I suspect a lot of this money is going into investment into private armies, private weapons, and private space programs. And that means, in the long run, our future is not just on planet Earth, but in space as well. So this is a long-distance run, and we're talking about a very deep change in our civilization. And so we need to take a deep breath and be prepared for more change, because we're leaving where we've been, and we're going to someplace new. The next thing, 8, assume the people in charge are aliens. Now, what do I mean by that? Are aliens really in charge? No, I don't know that. I don't understand really who's in charge, and I'm certainly not privy to their, you know, to their board minutes. But the reality is that the people who are in charge look at you and me as if we were a different species. And this is very hard for most people to fathom. Most people have enormous empathy for other humans. They don't view other humans the way you and I view, you know, our neighbor's chickens. But we need to understand that the people in charge really, for a variety of reasons, look at us as if we were aliens. And that means that they don't have the empathy. They don't have the empathy with us that we assume that they do. And why they're behaving the way they're behaving, it's impossible to tell. Is it because they're managing UFOs? Is it because of geophysical changes? It's part of the uncertainty we deal with. But we are being trained financially, and ultimately that means many of us will lose years or lives, and how do we stop and reverse that train? That's part of what we want to figure out. So I go back to this idea of taking responsibility. If we assume the people in charge are literally view us as a different species, then we need to go to work on real solutions and get really difficult to harvest and organize ourselves in ways that align positively with what can be aligned positively and avoid that which is negative. But we need to be much more savvy about the cultures and the powerful cultures we're dealing with. The future's invented, it's not destined, and literally we're in a situation where we're dealing with groups of people whose vision of our future is very different from our vision, and that's a struggle, that's a war. And it's one we need to understand and we need to be savvy about. So I say think of them as aliens, not because I mean they're from another planet. It's because literally, psychologically and emotionally at this point, they might as well be from another planet. Number 9 is see the opportunity. One of the reasons for many years I've been extraordinarily optimistic is because having spent a great deal of time and money in the 90s trying to understand how the economy works by place, I have a profound understanding of how much is wasted. One of the reasons I love being in Switzerland is I love being in a country where you're among a group of people who optimize everything continuously all the time, who pay a much lower corruption tax. You're driving through communities, through cities where wealth can be optimized because the corruption related to that place and that community is significantly less. And I've told you the story of our circle where we we asked ourselves, it's my little Solari circle that we meet by bridge call, if we optimize, if we were free to optimize wealth on planet Earth, what, how much wealth could be created relative to now? And I said my estimate was that the current wealth was 1% of what was possible, or less than 1%. It's interesting, the whole circle was 1 to 20%. So if you understand that the wealth that can be created if we could manage the planet on a different model, it's quite extraordinary. Number 10 is, I want to recommend the Solari model to you, and I'll go through it briefly. I've written much about it up on the blog. Really, I spent the 90s trying to come up with a way we could manage money and resources that would be, could produce literally that, you know, take wealth from 1% to 100%. And what I realized was, after many years of prototyping, that it was really quite simple. And that was, if we took the time to understand the impact of our investments, whether our time and our money, that's what I call the total economic return, and use that information as a navigation tool to try and reduce our risk and increase our return, subject to one rule, never try and never do anything that has a negative total economic return. So essentially, do no harm. It's the surgeon's motto. That literally that one change in protocol in our money management across many populations could produce incredible wealth under one condition, and that was there was sufficient transparency for people on an open basis to see and understand their economic impact. And I think as the internet moves forward and more transparency in many ways moves forward, we're beginning to see more and more of that. And it's very, very positive. And frankly, if we want to use the law of attraction to outwit the pro-centralization team, it's an absolutely essential protocol and one that can work individually in our lives. People around me are always hearing me say, we need to give each other energy. And part of getting away from a culture built around cheap money and getting back to a culture that really practices sound practices in the real economy is learning how to align with each other in a way where we really help each other get energy, whether it's save each other money, save each other time, help each other make money, all the different ways. It's, you know, it's very unique. And that's why it's very important to take the time to understand each other's needs, because the way we're going to build community, whether it's network or within our place, is by looking for ways to help each other, particularly with the elemental parts of life, the food, clothing, shelter. And it's part of building the kind of community that means, you know, that our precious metals can be safe and we only need so much vodka and whiskey and bullets. So my message from Switzerland is choose life. And I think we're going into a time where it's important to reaffirm and choose life all the time and every day and not listen to the people who say it's hopeless, not listen to fear. Yes, understand the risk. There are plenty of risks, and it's very important to know what they are and pay attention to them. But as you do, listen to them so that we can choose life. I predict the Swiss will come out on top no matter what happens, but I also believe that you can, and so can I, and may it be so. Just remember also what my friend Caroline Casey says. She says, our circumstances are far too dire for the luxury of realism. Okay, very briefly, let's go to the movies. Battlestar Galactica is a science fiction TV series that was on the Sci-Fi Channel from 2000, started, the miniseries ran in December 2003, and it ran for 4 seasons until 2009. In a million years, I would never have watched this, and I'm very, you know, I try everything. But David Lichty, my wonderful partner, leader of Solari Silver and Gold, persuaded me to watch it, and I immediately became addicted. It is by far and away my favorite television series of all time. I got it through Netflix. I finally loved it so much I went out and bought the whole Battlestar Galactica in DVD. The story, very briefly, is about a civilization that lives on 12 planets. It's called the 12 Colonies. They are attacked and almost wiped out by a cybernetic race known as the Silence, who they had created some time before. Approximately 50,000 human survivors flee on spacecraft led by what appears to be the only military ship left in the colonial fleet, the Battlestar Galactica, which is commanded by Commander Adama, played by Edward Olmos, and President Laura Roslin, played by Mary McDonnell. And the story is the story of the Galactica and its crew and this small fleet of survivors looking for a fabled refuge known as Earth as they're chased by the Cylons trying to kill them. Now, why is this so wonderful? First of all, it's truly Shakespearean. It asks all the great questions. Who are we? Why are we here? What's important? How do we create and maintain a civilization? It explores so many of the important questions of why it's, you know, how can men and women work together and support each other, which is one of the things we really have to figure out. So much has been done to turn men and women against each other. How can you use intuitive and explicit knowledge to work together? How do you get the military leadership and the civilian leadership to work together? They explore tremendous struggles, and it all comes down to the character of the military commander and the president, which is so fascinating. One of the great lines, military versus civilian, is the commander is irritated with the president for something. He says, "We are at war." And she looks at him and says, "No, we're not. We lost the war. Now we need to go somewhere and make babies." It's a great portrayal of the tensions. Explore every issue about classes and hierarchies, human versus machine, which is a very important issue that's coming upon us as artificial intelligence and nanotechnology and chips take hold. We're beginning to watch the integration of the human race with the machines, and this is explored tremendously in Battlestar Galactica. All sorts of questions about allocation and optimization of resources, how you do it right and fairly, some minor themes that are very important, the dangers of being networked. The Battlestar Galactica survives because it's relatively low-tech, and it explores our enemies living among us and losing enemies into the intimacy of sort of coming together. So it's certainly a long, four seasons is a long time, but it's really an extraordinary artistic production, and I recommend it to you. It explores many of the questions that we're going to explore during this transition as it grows more serious, and ultimately it's extremely hopeful, so I recommend it to you. Well, that's it for this evening. In closing, no Solari Report next week. We start in October with our third quarter wrap-up. We have a lot to cover. Precious metals will be the following week. We have much to talk about. Don't forget, we really want to help you at Solari Silver and Gold. Please feel free to call. Talk with David Lichty and when I'm back in Europe with me, and we want to help. There's a lot to be done there. So until October and the third quarter wrap-up, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.